Hey everyone, and thanks for joining us for another episode of Lit Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Teja. Today, I'm joined by Miles Downey to talk about his classic book, Effective Modern Coaching, now published in a new edition. Miles Downey is recognized as one of the world's leading business coaches. He was the founder of the School of Coaching in 1996, the first institution in Europe to focus exclusively on the development of coaching skills for coaches, managers, and leaders. He's the author of Enabling Genius and The Enabling Manager. Effective Modern Coaching is a classic and inspiring book. It aims to develop managers and executives into great coaches who can transform the performance of individuals and teams in their organizations. Hi, Miles. Thank you very much for joining us on the Lit Radio podcast. It's a great pleasure to have you with us once again. So the reason for you being here is, of course, the new edition of your classic book, Effective Modern Coaching. So that's now the fourth edition of the book. But before we discuss that more, could you tell us why you decided to write the first edition back in 1999?
Coaching had only emerged as a kind of a professional discipline in the world of business within the kind of the 10 years or so, 15 years maybe before that. And there was there were one or two books, but nothing that was a kind of a practical how-to guide. So the idea was that I'd write something that would be that guide, that something that would become a handbook for people interested in coaching. And also a resource for people who are learning to coach. And I'm pleased to say that happened. I go to conferences and people show up with 20-year-old books and ask me to sign them. So that's gorgeous. But the even more than that, what brought me into coaching in the first place was a kind of a driving interest in how you help people leverage their potential. So, you know, and achieve results that are meaningful for them. And that's always been the interest in how you help people develop their own authority. And when I say authority, I mean their capacity to author their life, to deliver things that are meaningful to them. So it's kind of about psychological agency, I guess. So yeah, that was where it started from.
Oh, absolutely. And since then, you've sold more than 300,000 copies in various languages. So, I mean, that's a lot when you think about it.
Yeah.
But could you tell us a little bit more about this new fourth edition? Why do you think now is the right time for that book to come out? And what new content can readers find in it?
Okay, so two things there, really. In recent years, I've had lots of, you know, senior leaders in business that I bump into who say to me, when we start talking about coaching, if we start talking about coaching, I had a coach a few years ago and they were a really nice person, but I'm not sure what difference was made. And that's kind of really concerning, because if the coaching isn't making a difference, then people aren't buying it. And if people aren't buying it, then that opportunity to make a difference is lost. So that's been really troubling me for a number of years. And it's almost as if coaching has lost its shine, that, you know, in the early 2000s, coaching was, you know, the way of helping senior executives, senior people move forward, achieve results. And maybe it got out of hand then, maybe there was too much, maybe people were paying too much for it. But it's lost its shine. It's lost its way. And there's a thing. If you've ever had a Pilates lesson, they have a thing which it looks like an instrument from the Marquis de Sade, which is called a reformer, and you lie on it. And the intention behind it is to help you realign your body again. It's a reformer. So in writing the book, it's kind of my Pilates reformer. I'm trying to get back to the simplicity of what coaching is. It's a skill. It's not a psychology, it's not a philosophy, it's not neuroscience, it's not a fad. So I'm trying to get back to that simplicity, and I'm trying to kind of, I because of what's happened to coaching, I have to go back to what are the fundamentals? What makes this work? So two things that are different are a real deep delve into what makes coaching work. And an example of that is the notion of a personal construct. So we kind of think that the ideas we have in our heads are the truth. And my truth, God forbid. And it's not. It's simply a construct, a kind of a mental model that helps you navigate the world. And that's really useful. So why coaching is important is that it helps people explore their construct. It doesn't impose new ones on them, new bad ways of doing things. It helps them explore their own constructs and alter them so that it's a better fit with the world. And that's a fundamental reason for adopting a coaching approach. So that's one thing that's different, getting into the what's underneath it all. And the other thing is there was another book that my friends at LID helped me publish called Enabling Genius, which we have to get up to the 33,000 copies, but it may take a little longer. But what genius is about the high performance, helping people perform right to their best. So clearly that's important in the world of coaching. And it looks at it in terms of how you help leaders understand who they are as leaders, what's their unique individual genius as a leader. But it also helps the coach understand when they're coaching, when they show up as a coach, who's showing up? And having a real grasp of what their unique skills and abilities are as a coach so that they do more of that. So that's the second bit that I think is compelling and different. And it's fair to say, if people have bought the book, the previous editions, that there's a chunk in the middle which is edited, so it's tighter. But it's the same core material, but I still believe that there's, back to my reformer, that there's validity in rereading that and reacquainting yourself with the essence of it.
Absolutely, but it's very interesting what you say, that coaches and coaching are not held in as high regard as in the past. So could you share with us what are the reasons for that?
Well, one is, and the kind of the coaching profession has got to take this on the chin, which is that the quality of most coaching and therefore the skill sets of lots of people who do coaching, it's well below par. I mean, well below par. There are fundamental skills that people simply don't know how to do. So one of the core skills is the coach's ability to help the other person think something through. So not to put ideas in their heads, but simply to follow their own line of thought. And that's a fundamental skill. But you won't find that being taught anywhere. And you really, really well. It might be mentioned and it's called non-directive coaching, but you won't find a description anywhere but in this book of what non-directive coaching actually looks like and how it works. That's the only place I found the model for it. So one, the quality of coaching is very poor. You can do a one-day course and call yourself a coach and get a kind of diploma. You don't even have to show up. I've been coaching for, I'm 64. I've been coaching since I was 28. Somebody else could do the maths. I have only been observed by a client coaching on one occasion. That's got to be wrong. So the criteria by which people are buying also don't work. So the people who on the buyer side, the HR agents responsible for bringing coaching into organizations, mostly don't know what they're trying to do. They don't know against what criteria they're making this selection. And they're probably choosing things from places like the International Coach Federation or the EMCC, European Mentoring and Coaching Council. And they don't have tight definitions of coaching. So it's really difficult. And they don't observe coaches. Their job is to have lots of people. So they're kind of inclusive organizations. Coaching needs to be exclusive. If you can't do it, you don't get the medal. So there's quality of the coaching, the quality of the buying, and then there's a third thing, which is actually in a way it's the most profound, because coaching has become about, coaching in the world of business at any rate, has become about development. It's how you help people become leaders or grow in whatever way they need to grow, or it's how you turn somebody around who isn't performing well. So it's a developmental focus. That's useful. I'm not going to say you can't do that. In fact, obviously, you should be doing that. But boy, is it a waste of something useful. I mean, if you go into any other discipline, elite performers in any other discipline have their coach there to help them win the tournament or the match or whatever it is. So we need to reframe coaching in the world of business around performance. We need to be helping our clients achieve real world, important business results. And that then tells you if and how they need to develop. So if I understand from a person I'm coaching what it is they're trying to achieve, and then I say, oh, brilliant. Okay, so how do you need to change or grow in order to be able to do that? Now development becomes something really meaningful. Showing up and saying, I want to help, you know, to a senior leader and saying, I want to help you be a better person, you're going to see the door pretty quickly from the other side. So quality of coaching, quality of buying, and it's a development focus when it should be a performance focus. Boom.
Yes, very interesting sharing those three main reasons. And you say that one of those reasons is the poor quality of coaching. That's why my next question is, how would you define effective modern coaching?
It's at one level, it's a description of a simple set of skills, a way of helping people, others achieve results. But the key word is effective. That I define it by, is this going to achieve business results? Is this going to help people be more effective and more efficient in their role? Is it going to deliver growth and learning? Is it going to help people grow and take hold of their own authority, their own agency, be bigger, better leaders? Is it going to release innovation? And then at a more subtle level, effective coaching, because I'm helping the other person think it through for themselves for the most part, what that does is it leaves responsibility with the other person. So the coach is not the responsible entity. They're not going to do the actions. They're not going to behave differently. It's the other person. So the other person has got to take responsibility. So if I tell somebody what to do, it's unlikely they're going to take responsibility. I've got to have an approach that allows them to think it through for themselves. And that's why the effective coaching model leaves responsibility to the other person, because it also leads to the last thing, which is about sustainability. Again, if you tell people what to do, one, they won't do it, but it's also a waste of time, because even if they do it once, they certainly won't do it twice. So it's not sustainable. So that those outcomes that define effectiveness define the model. That if I want to achieve those things, I've got to enable the other person to stand in their own shoes, be all they can be. Telling isn't going to work.
Definitely. And could you tell us a little bit more about your effective modern coaching model or approach, and how a coach could enable those things that you just mentioned?
So if you get very simplistic, and that's not always easy, but you know, if you look at what's happening in a coaching conversation, there are a number of entities present. There's the person being coached. I call them the player, not the coachee, because coachee is a horrible word. And there's the coach. And there's also the context. There's the organization in which the person is working. Most very often, that's forgotten in coaching interactions. But that exists. And it's not just that the person you're coaching should be brilliant and achieve. It's that they should achieve something for the organization. And then there's the relationship. So there are four things: me, the other person, context, and us, the relationship between us. So it's those skills, when I take those four entities and I think about the player, then my job as the coach is to help them. They call it non-directive coaching, which isn't a great expression, but it is the set of skills that enable somebody to think through for themselves, to problem solve for themselves, to create for themselves, rather than being told. And then The second bit is sometimes, you know, I've been around the block a few times. I know some stuff. And I'm going to, you know, if that's useful, I'm going to give it to that other person. So there's a set of skills that are involved in me helping that person through my own resources, my own experiences. I can solve problems. I can be creative. And sometimes that's really useful to the people I'm coaching. Sometimes I need to teach them a model I know. So I'm not going to say you don't do that. So that's kind of the more directive thing. Then I've got to be able to manage the relationship. I've got to be able to create the relationship in the first place. And I've got to watch the dynamics that emerge over time between two people. Are you getting too close? Are you losing objectivity? All kinds of things can happen in the relationship. And then, and the fourth set then is my ability almost to consult, to inquire about what's going on in the context and how the work we're doing is going to make a difference to the organization. Or put the other way around, is the organization doing anything that's going to mess up the coaching? Because sometimes there's stuff going on, the organizational politics that get in the way of a person being fully productive. So those four things are kind of the basis of the approach.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I would encourage our listeners to grab a copy of the book to read more about that in more depth, of course.
Buy two. It's small.
Yeah, absolutely. But now let's talk about the characteristics of an effective coach. What skills do a person need to possess to be effective at coaching?
So I go back to some of the things that I've just said. So the at the top of the list is there's this weird thing that some people may have heard of, a gentleman by name of Tim Galway, who wrote a book called The Inner Game of Tennis. It's a multi-million selling book, and it contains some really useful, profound ideas. And somewhere in another book he wrote called Inner Tennis, he said these words, said, awareness is curative. And what he was saying was that the very act of paying attention to something, and he was talking about tennis at the time, has that thing changed. So by noticing how you're hitting the ball, your forehand, your backhand, whatever it is, by noticing and getting absolutely engrossed in your innate capacity to learn kicks in and it begins to change and shift. Awareness is curative. So that principle applies in coaching, that by somebody speaking about something to another person, through that process, they become more aware of the problem they're facing, of the opportunity they're tracking down, of the skill they need to learn, the way that, whatever it is. So by speaking it through, they begin to see it more clearly. And that's when they get the insight. They got kind of that kind of aha moment of, oh, of course, I should have realized. And then that's where so that idea, the first set of skills, we call it non-directive, but it's really about raising awareness. So the person uses their own innate abilities to move forward. Then the second bit is the kind of the directive end of the spectrum, which is about proposing. It's my using my resources to offer a suggestion or make an observation or give feedback. So that's another skill set. Then the third skill set is about the relationship. It's about the building the relationship, managing the relationship, noticing the dynamics and how things change. It's about bringing the conversation to a close, the relationship to a close at a certain point, that's in a satisfactory way for both. And it's about the consulting skills, the ability to be able to look at the organization and see how that's impacting the coaching relationship.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing those, Miles. But of course, there are a lot of difficulties when coaching. So could you share with us some of the main obstacles and pitfalls of an effective coach?
So of an ineffective coach, the obstacles and pitfalls are limitless and unnumberable. But somebody who's competent, because they've read the book, somebody who's competent, there are places that are that commonly get messed people up, and When I sit down with somebody for the first time, and we're contemplating a coaching relationship over a period of time, what I'm listening for, trying to identify is, okay, what's the job that we're here to do, this person and me? And if I worked with a very talented psychotherapist many years ago, and in one of our conversations, her name was Nambicha Moore. I'm sitting there kind of saying whatever I'm saying. And after about 10 minutes in, she said, oh, that's why you're here today. And she'd had a visceral experience of understanding, of insight into me in that moment, what was important. And it's almost the same thing. I'm listening to hear, so hold on, what's the job that we're here to do? And it goes beyond kind of success criteria and objectives. It's, you know, fundamentally, what's the job we're here to do? And coaching mostly doesn't work when that isn't clear, when it's not clear to the coach and probably not clear to the player. So the first thing is really making sure you've understood that's the job to be done. That's about the biggest pitfall. The second, and we've kind of spoken about this, is the contextual piece. That I think in the coaching relationships that I've had where it hasn't worked, it's almost always that there's been something outside of the relationship that's gotten in the way. I coached many years ago the CFO of one of our retail banks. He'd been told by more senior people that he needed to be a better leader in the organization. And he'd been kind of slightly demoted from the full CFO role and moved sideways. So over a period of 6 months when we were working together, he didn't really have a great job. So he was dipping in and out of things. So he wasn't forming any relationships. There was nothing to lead. So he was still seen to be failing as a leader. So it's like it wasn't. So no matter what we did, it was very difficult to help him show up in the organization. We achieved some things, but not. And eventually, I engineered a meeting with the chief executive. What's going on here? And the reality of it was that she and the HR director had decided that this guy was no longer wanted in the company. And that's a rather extreme example, but it's like, so he could never succeed with those things going on. He was not seen to fit. He was too old. He was a man. They needed more diversity, blah, blah, blah. And he didn't get on with the CEO. He was never going to succeed. So I could, so of course, at that point, the nature of the coaching conversation changed. But if you're not inquiring as to stuff that's going on outside of the coaching relationship within the organization, you're going to make mistakes. So those are the two big things: not understanding the job to be done, and stuff in the context.
Yeah, very interesting again. But I would move on to the last part of the book, where very interestingly you talk about coaching and flow. So what's the connection between these two?
Well, actually, there's an immediate kind of connection, but actually there's one that goes back in time. I mentioned Tim Galway. Tim Galway, author of The Inner Game of Tennis, had a notion which he described as, he said there are two selves. There's self one and self two. And self one is the part of you that unfortunately society feeds. It's the part of you that wants to get things right, that tries probably too hard, that's very narrowly focused, that is fed by fear and doubt. So it's like, I'm not good enough, or, you know, negative self-beliefs, all of that stuff. Self two, on the other hand, is when self one diminishes, the doubt goes away, the fear goes away, and the individual shows up in a state that's pretty much like flow. There is no interference. They're just completely present to the job in front of them, and they perform to their best. So that's another way of saying flow. Flow is the mental state in which people perform to their best. And so when I'm coaching somebody, my job is to be in flow, because I'm going to do my best coaching. So the first thing is my first job when I show up with somebody is to do whatever I can to be in flow, to be in self too. And that means making sure I get there on time, make sure I'm fully prepared, but also that I very quickly get to be fully present and focused on the person I'm with, and kind of let the rest of the world diminish and disappear. My second job is to help them get into flow, so that they're relaxed, they're fully present. So I in a major international strategic management consultancy, which I won't name, I used to work with one of their senior partners managing an office, a European office. And it took us, because his world was so crazy, we developed a pattern in which we were polite to each other for a few minutes about, you know, what was happening in our worlds. And then he would say to me, "So Miles, how is your business?" And I would never let anybody else do that, because I trusted this guy's intentions and his clarity about how he managed himself. Because in doing that, in asking me how I was, what actually he was doing was he was tuning out the rest of the world and getting focused on the two of us. And after a while, then I'd have to say, "Okay, and name, that's enough about me. How about you?" And he'd go, "Ah." And then we'd identified four or five different kind of topic areas. He still has to sell work to clients. He has to manage the partners in the office. Da, 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 da. So we had those buckets, and I'd get him to speak about each one just briefly. So he was kind of, and as he spoke, you could see, and then he'd get to the end of telling me about what was going on. And I'd say, "Okay, so of all of those things that you've mentioned, what do we need to speak about today?" And by the time I got to that question, my friend was completely focused, completely present, and could do great work. And that meant we got about 40 minutes of really good work out of the hour. So that it's such an important thing. The third piece on flow is that if one of the reasons I coach is that I help people to spend more time in flow, that they identify what they're great at, they spend more time doing that, they get better at it. They either give away the things they're not good at or find ways of getting efficient at them. And the more time people spend in work, in flow, the more productive they'll be, the more they'll enjoy it, the more innovative they'll be, the more people around them will share in that. So it's one of those unspoken, unseen things that makes a massive difference. It kind of to the point where I think it's probably almost the next frontier in working life is to understand how people can spend more time in flow.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see how important being in flow is to give your best results.
Yeah.
Really.
Yeah.
And then I want to ask you one, well, very interesting question for me at least. So recently, probably in the past couple of years, there has been a lot of talk, you know, also in the media about the role of Gen Z in today's workplace. So I guess some employers are now coaching their employees who are from Generation Z. So is it any different coaching them compared to the other generations in the workplace?
What the coach does is pretty much the same. So your job is to, as I said, help somebody use their own innate abilities to make progress and move forward. But it does come up with kind of a different spin and a different flavor, not least because it kind of works two ways. Generation Z has been given a lot of bad press about, you know, the desire to do work that's meaningful, about, you know, working in times and places that they want to, not having kind of too much external pressures placed upon them, you know, not enjoying the kind of and people of my generation and younger generations grew up in a culture of compliance. We did as we're told. And Generation Z has kind of to some degree rejected that. But I, you know, the other side of that coin is, aren't they smart? It's like, isn't that a great way to do things, to do work that's meaningful? to seek work that's meaningful, to seek some more autonomy in your work, to work where and when you want, when you're inspired, as long as you produce the results. So it's like, maybe we should all have a touch of that is one way of looking at it. So there's two sides to that. And therefore there when you're coaching, there are two sides to it. Because when you get to work with somebody like that, who really believes, genuinely believes in those values, that's great fun. Because they're there to do a good job. So you can really help them, and you can help them live out those values and multiply and accelerate them. So that's a blast. So it can be an easier job. When those values, when they aren't generally held, and you've just got a lazy bastard who wants to stay in bed all day, then it's more difficult. But it's the same process, the process of as I said earlier, of raising awareness, of having a person see what's blocking them and getting in their way. Because they're not having fun if they don't want to show up at work, if they want to spend all day in bed in their pajamas. That's no fun at all. And it's the route to depression and whatever else. So helping somebody see that and turning it around and getting inspired and understanding what it is that turns them on and what meaningful work is for them and helping them find it. That's a great thing, but it is more difficult. And there is that occasionally that sense of almost entitlement and privilege that, I should be being paid more. And, it's like, whatever it is, no, you still have to do hard work. That's the unfortunate news. But it's on balance, that Gen Z thing properly appreciated actually leads to more productivity, more learning, more fun.
Definitely. But I guess it's good news that at least the approach doesn't have to change.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, fascinating. And Miles, I have one last question for you to end this fascinating conversation. So what would be your top three tips for anyone who has to coach other people for the first time? What are the three things that they need to make sure they do right?
The first thing would be to make sure that you as the coach first, and then the person you're coaching, understand what the job to be done is, that there's absolute clarity. It's solve this problem, find a way of working this project, that there's real clarity about the job you're there to do together, real clarity about that. So I was working with somebody the other day, helping them build their ability in sales. And it was a fairly general conversation. And it took us a while, but after a while it got down. The guy mentioned that he had more difficulty. He had easier conversations when he was working with women than with men. And I listened and I got it. And I said, oh. And of course, what emerged was that he found it easier to build rapport. And in that moment, that's the job. We have to understand how you build rapport with men. And once we'd understood what the job was, we could go to work. So there's that. Make sure that at the end of it, they own the outcome. And that's best done by asking questions. Questions like, so how do you understand this? What could you do about it? What other options do you have? And if they're coming up with answers to those questions, they're going to own the outcome. But if they don't own the outcome, nothing changes. And then the final one would be kind of attendant on the last, which is if there isn't, particularly if people are hesitant, nervous, worried, if there isn't absolute clarity about what the next steps are, they probably won't take them. So you've got to make sure they're really, really clear about what they're signing up to. That makes a big difference. And the simpler you do it, you make it, the better. They say, well, I guess I should write that report then. Okay. What's the first thing you have to do before you write the report? What do you mean? I don't know. What's the first thing you have to do? Oh, well, I guess I'd have to assemble all my notes. Okay, anything else? And it's like when you get down to that level of granularity, you're It sounds tedious and a bit, but actually, what you're doing is reducing barriers to people doing the work. Because they don't end up sitting in front of their desk saying, "Oh, I have to write a report. How do I do that?" No, they already know. They've got to assemble their notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Miles, for sharing those tips and guidance and for this overall very insightful conversation. Of course, I would encourage our listeners to grab a copy of the new edition of
Yes.
Effective Modern Coaching, which is a fabulous, brilliant read. But thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Taya.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you keep an eye on our social media at Lit Publishing on LinkedIn, X, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook for more information about new books and podcasts with thought leaders. See you next time on Lit Radio Podcast.